Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, it's 60 years ago this week that the Beatles first came to Florida and played the Ed Sullivan Show from Miami. We'll talk with Bob Keeling, author of the book Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida.
They really fell in love with America. You know, they got to see palm trees for the first time, beaches. This was a big deal for a bunch of young guys from workaday Liverpool, England, to come here.
The five-year cycle of Afrofuturism conferences presented as part of the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities has concluded. We'll talk with historians Scott French and Julian Chambliss.
What do you do to protect heritage spaces? And what does it mean to sort of like think through that from a policy or a community standpoint? And what is the role of institutions in that? Those things all got spoken about.
And while the indigenous people of Florida didn't have a Super Bowl, the Apalachee did play a ball game that was an important part of their culture. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. In early 1964, America, and Florida in particular, was still feeling the impact of the Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The president had visited several cities in Florida just days before he was killed in Texas on November 22, 1963. When the Beatles arrived in America just a couple of months later, their upbeat music was a welcome change of pace. Bob Keeling is author of the new book, Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, published by Florida Humanities and the University Press of Florida.
Ben, I was lucky enough to interview numerous primary sources, people who were there. One example is Gail Cameron, who was a young correspondent from Life magazine in the 60s, and she was right there at Ground Zero at Camelot with JFK and Jackie, and she talked about, you know, in 63, when the tragic assassination of JFK took place, it was as if the whole country was just in this collective malaise. They couldn't believe that a president with so much promise and youth and vigor could be taken away so terribly. And that really underscores the importance of the Beatles. She said hearing "I Want to Hold Your Hand" for the first time was like the nation had permission to smile again. It was like these strangers from overseas were coming to remind us about what joy was. And they were there to conquer America. And because of the recent events that had happened, America was ready for the Beatles. They needed a lift, and the Beatles were there to provide it.
The Beatles came to New York to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9, 1964. They arrived in Miami on February 13th to make another appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show from the Deauville Hotel.
The Deauville performance was particularly significant because, unlike their first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show, this was done from a working beach resort. You can imagine how busy it is anyway, and they're trying to stage this nationally televised show where the technology is a lot more primitive than it is today. But they muddled through. The Beatles did great. I was lucky enough to interview Ed Sullivan's grandson, who was standing just a few feet from the Beatles. And he said, "I will never forget that music. It is as if it's etched into my soul." And the Beatles loved the Deauville so much, they decided they didn't want to go back home. So it ended up being sort of a residency there in South Florida. They were there for almost 9 days, and they wrote some of the songs for A Hard Day's Night. They really fell in love with America. You know, they got to see palm trees for the first time and beaches. This was a big deal for a bunch of young guys from workaday Liverpool, England, to come here. They got to date American women and go to restaurants and have their first home-cooked meal in America with their bodyguard, Sergeant Buddy Dresner, in his home in North Miami Beach.
One of the greatest strengths of the book Good Day Sunshine State, in addition to Bob Keeling's storytelling ability, is the large number of interviews he conducted and acquired with people involved in the Beatles' visits to Florida. Policeman Buddy Dresner was one of those people.
His son provided me a videotape interview that he did with his dad back in the early 2000s. And, you know, a policeman comes knocking on his door. He was the overnight shift guy. And he's like, why is this guy waking me up during the day? You know, and they say, you're going to be assigned to the Beatles. And Buddy's like, what is that? And he was educated very quickly when he saw the footage of the Beatles' arrival in the United States. And there were 200 police officers trying to keep security. And he said, I think we only have about 60 on our entire force down here. So he knew this was a big job. But what was great about Buddy was he had this wonderful sort of sense of humor. He could be a fatherly figure. He could be sort of like a big brother. He could joke around with them. But at the end of the day, when it was time to get serious, the Beatles knew it was, you know, it was time to do that. And he became a friend, a protector, as I said, something of a father figure. He had them over to his house for dinner. You know, the Beatles in a little cop's house in North Miami Beach, you know. And so it was very compelling that Buddy took him into his family. And at one point, the job was so big, he ended up rooming with George at the Deauville just to save time going back and forth. So Buddy's a really key character in the first half of this book. And they couldn't have had a better bodyguard than Sergeant Dresner.
In 1964, the Beatles spent more time in Florida than anywhere else in the United States, both fulfilling professional obligations and relaxing. There's an iconic photograph of the four Beatles together in a pool that made the cover of Life magazine. Bob Keeling spoke with everyone involved in creating that image.
The entire Life staff, from Gail Cameron, who was the reporter who recounted being on the 12th floor of the Deauville pleading with John Lennon, please do this. You know, the Beatles are down there thinking, you know, they're going to have a holiday, but no, now they're going to go have to work and do a photo shoot. And she's saying, this is such a big deal. And he's finally like, okay, love, we'll do it. And so they go to this house on Biscayne Bay and they get in the pool and they do it. And it's just so iconic. And I also interviewed John Lowengard, who actually took that iconic photograph. And he said at the time, I really didn't think it was that big a deal. I didn't think it was that good. And then years later, my teenage daughter's friend asked if she could touch my hand just because it was the hand that took the picture of the Beatles in the swimming pool. So it's definitely an iconic photo and very representative of their time in Florida and their first visit to the United States.
The Deauville Hotel in Miami, where the Beatles stayed and performed live for a national audience on the Ed Sullivan Show, was demolished last year due to neglect. Bob Keeling was among those who actively fought for the historic structure to be preserved, but ultimately the owners were not interested in the building's history. The Beatles returned to Florida in September of 1964 to play a concert at the Gator Bowl in Jacksonville, but a hurricane forced a detour to Key West.
They had played Montreal the night of the 8th, September 8th, and Ringo actually had death threats by some anti-Semitic groups. And he would say, I'm not Jewish. Regardless, this was a threat they took very seriously. And when their show was over, they said, let's get the heck out of here. And they wanted to fly all night to Jacksonville. And there's this bad weather forecast. So Larry Kane, who was traveling with them, the Miami newsman, said, let's go down to Key West. So those were the circumstances why they ended up down there. But it was a very historic 2.5 days there. And there's one part, especially with John and Paul, where, you know, they'd had this stressful tour. They were finally getting to relax for a couple of nights before they had to go back to Jacksonville on the 11th. And Paul talks about that night is a really specific time where he and John had drank a little too much, but they really got down to talking about how much each other meant to both of them. And it was a really important connection that they made, that Paul talked about it specifically after John died. And in some lyrics, he talked about, you remember that time we cried because we couldn't keep it all inside, or words to that effect. That was the night in Key West that he was referring to.
After staying in Key West, the Beatles headed to Jacksonville to perform their only full concert in Florida. The group became civil rights activists of sorts shortly after Martin Luther King Jr. had been jailed in North Florida.
One of the people I was so fortunate to be able to interview at length for hours was Larry Kane. And at the time, Larry was a 21-year-old radio newsman in Miami. He had met them when they first came, and then he sent a letter saying, hey, I'd love to get an interview when you come to Jacksonville. Well, instead, he was invited to go on the entire tour with the Beatles, as opposed to the disc jockeys who might do an interview saying, hey, are you guys going to break up soon? Why do you keep your hair so long? Larry Kane was the kind of a guy who was tapping into the Beatles' developing worldview. And soon enough, they would become social agents of change. In Las Vegas, Larry was the one who asked, you know, there's a very good chance the Gator Bowl show in Jacksonville could be segregated. What do you think about that? And the Beatles said, there's a rider in our contract for every single promoter who puts on our show that we will not be required to perform in front of segregated audiences.
The influence of the Beatles on young musicians really can't be overstated. One of the many young people who was greatly impacted by the Beatles was Florida musician Tom Petty.
You'll see interviews with guys like Tom Petty, with Don Felder from Gainesville, with Mike Campbell, who grew up in Jacksonville, with Ronnie Van Zant from Lynyrd Skynyrd, Stephen Stills, who was the only musician inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for two different bands on the same night, the Allman Brothers. All of these guys either grew up in Central Florida or were actually born and raised here, like Tom Petty. All of them talk about the profound influence of the Beatles and how important it was. And so clearly their travels in 1964 and here in the Sunshine State were crucial in planting that seed for generations of iconic musicians to come.
Bob Keeling is author of the new book, Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, published by Florida Humanities and the University Press of Florida. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to listen to archived editions of this program, watch our public television series, Florida Frontiers, find out about upcoming events, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic are considered an Afrofuturist band, incorporating science fiction and futuristic themes in their music. George Clinton performed at the Zora Neale Hurston Festival of the Arts and Humanities in 2022, and as Sebastian Garcia explains, that event just recently completed a five-year cycle of Afrofuturism conferences.
Dr. Julian Chambliss is a professor of English with an appointment in history and the Val Berryman Curator of History at the MSU Museum at Michigan State University. In addition, he is a core participant in the MSU College of Arts and Letters Consortium for Critical Diversity in a Digital Age Research, CDART for short. His research focuses on race, culture, and power in real and imagined urban spaces. His recent writing has appeared in the American Historical Review, Phylon, Freeze Magazine, Rhetoric Review, and the Boston Review. Lastly, Dr. Chambliss was the curator of the 2020 to 2024 Zora Festival Afrofuturism Academic Conference Cycle. Dr. Scott French is an associate professor of history, director of public history, and associate director of the Center for Humanities and Digital Research at the University of Central Florida. He is the author of The Rebellious Slave, Nat Turner and American Memory, and has published extensively on African-American history, cultural landscapes, and sites of memory. His research on Edenville and its Hungerford School has been featured in the Zora Neale Hurston National Museum of Fine Arts, Winter Park Magazine, WUCF's Central Florida Road Trip, and CBS Sunday Morning. Dr. French chairs the Zora Festival Academics Committee and serves as UCF's lead organizer for the conference in collaboration with Afrofuturism Cycle curator, Dr. Julian Chambliss. I spoke with Dr. Chambliss and Dr. French about the 2024 Zora Festival Afrofuturism Conference, which was held in Eatonville, Florida. We also reflected on the 5-year cycle's conclusion more broadly. The thematic focus for this year's conference was the space of Afrofuturism. With the recent debates and controversy surrounding the historic Robert Hungerford School property in Eatonville, Florida, even Dr. Chambliss admitted how timely this conference was, not just for scholars, but for the public as well.
In terms of that relationship between a past set of questions related to space and a future set of questions related to space, that played itself out pretty well. And important sort of like interventions in terms of like real space and like what do you do to protect heritage spaces, and what does it mean to sort of like think through that from a policy or a community standpoint, and what is the role of institutions in that? Those things all got spoken about. And that's really important given where the town of Eatonville is and the big debates that, you know, only have grown more complex and more national and international in their context. I mean, I think more people know about the fate or concern about the fate of Eatonville because of the debates around the Robert Hungerford School property. So I always knew it was going to end up in space, and I always thought that was important, but I could have never predicted how some of the crises related to space would be so front of people's minds when we got here.
Dr. French offered an abridged timeline on how the debates about the Hungerford School property in Eatonville have grown more complex.
It is a kind of complex legal question, but I think it really starts with the community coming into awareness of a threat. School buildings were demolished. The historic Hungerford School buildings were demolished. I think people said, oh, this is getting real. And there were a number of community conversations around that where people talked about the experience of watching sort of the bulldozers come in and the dumpsters being filled with materials from the school and people holding up their cell phones and sort of witnessing this. And I think that's when it became real. I think there had been, for years, there had been discussion of developing this property. And so sometimes it's like, well, why did it suddenly become a crisis? It began to take form. There were actual developers with plans on the table, and the plans were being brought to the city. But the story sort of became more and more tied to certain decisions that would have to be made by the city of Eatonville. The city controlled a certain piece of this. The piece they had was the developers wanted a change to the comprehensive plan of the city. There have to be two hearings when there's a proposal to change the comprehensive plan. And there was a hearing at which the town council voted 4-1 in favor of making those changes that the developer wanted. It was between that vote and the next vote that all of the grassroots organizing took place. And we witnessed this, by the way, in my class. My class was following this, and we saw in real time, my digital history class, we watched the grassroots mobilization of opposition and the use of social media and, you know, hashtag activism. We saw the city council's vote flipped from 4-1 in favor of the changes to 3-2 against. And it was an amazing moment in democracy, right? This is Eatonville itself is a model of self-governance. It was built as an independent Black township in which self-governance was at the core, right? We will determine our own fate. It doesn't mean we will always agree, but we will decide the fate and future of this place. And so that sets up a clash now with the Orange County School Board. The developers, after that vote, they decided to drop their plans. And there was a push, some pressure on the school board. Okay, now this is your chance now. You can stop trying to sell this land. Give it back to Eatonville. That was the land back claim. Give it back. They refused to take that position. They left open. They said, we're going to pause, and we're going to leave open the future of this land. So this is about futurism. Everything is about what's going to happen.
As conference curators, Dr. Chambliss and Dr. French capitalized on this opportunity to connect the theme of space and Afrofuturism with the future space of the Hungerford School property. Both assiduously used the conference to engage with the public about these concrete issues.
Scott and I have been writing about like the Hungerford School as like an Afrofuturist space, and trying to think through what is represented by the space of the festival as a kind of cultural vehicle, right? Like a vehicle for visioning and thinking about Black culture. And so we're really sort of sensitive to this in a way that probably other people aren't. So some of it is like we're always trying to like translate what is something very complicated into moments of clarity, right? Like, you know, to hear Scott describe it, that's a really important point. But, you know, there's a way that that point is a long history in Eatonville that has these historical antecedents. Like, these are all very academic things that we can talk about, but can you tell the public that? So it's like, thinking about it as a curator, I'm like, oh, there are always big ideas here. Like, we always describe it, you know, as a public humanities project, but we're also mindful that, hey, you know, the person walking off the street has to understand what they saw. And that's always the sort of balancing act of it.
The connections between contemporary struggles and the Afrofuturism conference seem to align with the broader history of the Zora Festival, which is responsible for these cyclical academic conferences, as that annual event also originated from preservation issues.
That was a phrase heard also in Eatonville in the 1990s, when the county wanted to widen Kennedy Boulevard. It was the origin of the festival, of origin of the preserve the Eatonville community, was fighting a county plan to widen the road through Eatonville. It's tied to the festival because the festival grew out of that preservation effort.
Right, yeah. The idea that they wanted to widen the street leads to the creation of a coalition. And the argument, of course, is that Eatonville is a culturally important place because Holmes and Hurston, and to sort of emphasize that point, they started doing the festival in the midst of the fight, and that becomes the impetus also for them doing a National Historic Register campaign, and they get that. And so at some level, yes, it's the sort of county attempt to widen the road that leads to the creation of the Association of Preserving the Community, which leads to the creation of the festival as an annual event to remind people this is the Holmes and Hurston and celebrate it at our work.
And the oldest Black municipality in the United States, right?
Right.
But here we are, 35 years into the festival, and we're fighting, it's another existential crisis.
Right, it's an existential crisis because what happens to that space, because it's so large and the town itself is relatively tiny, it's impossible to imagine the kind of developments that are sort of suggested there and it not sort of fundamentally erasing the town. And it's important to recognize that I don't think anyone in Eatonville would say they don't want any development. Like, that's always this thing where, for various reasons, white people tend to listen to complaints, any sort of charge or resistance to development like this. It's like, oh, Black people don't want development. No, that's not true. It's not true. And Eatonville, they want development. They simply want development that will enhance the community as opposed to enrich the developer. So there's the difference, right?
Aside from the remarkably practical applications and implications of the space theme in this year's Afrofuturism conference, Dr. Chambliss explained how ending the conference cycle with space was crucial in evoking the fundamental core of what makes Eatonville so unique in American history.
When I was thinking about the cycle, part of the reason the space was going to end the cycle because I was trying to build towards a kind of ideological understanding around spaces, both this sort of like real thing, but also this sort of ideological landscape, because in some ways that returns the idea of Eatonville to its core as a future project. Because if you think about Afrofuturism as a Black practice, you can do it anytime. So you have to recognize that when the people who founded Eatonville, Joe Clark and these people, when they're involved in that process, they're really trying to create a space that's going to forecast into the future. They're trying to create like a future, a ship that Black people can get into in the midst of the sort of social, political, economic downturn that we associate within the deer. And this is their solution in a landscape where actually African-Americans have tried out many possible solutions.
When I asked Dr. Chambliss to reflect on his half a decade experience curating the Afrofuturism cycle during Zora Festival, he was incredibly proud of the conference's impact in and out of academia.
It takes time to understand the full impact of something. So, like I said, I think that more people legit would say Zora Hurston and Afrofuturist now than would have said it in 2019. And I think the reason they say that is because of this. I see more articles written about Zona Arista as Afrofuturist. I see more people talk about her that way. And I think within the sort of like closed group of academics who are Afrofuturists, they would have said that, but the broader public wouldn't have said it. And now, you know, there's like a big set of scholars who study Afrofuturism who didn't study it 5 or 6 years ago. And when they study, they go, oh, yeah, Zona Arista is Afrofuturist. So that's a big transformation. And like, that's a contribution. I have a long career in sort of public humanities work across a number of endeavors related to what I do. I think this is probably one of the most significant manifestations of that. I think I've documented why it's important and its benefits for many audiences. And I think a lot of people across, especially across, you know, Central Florida community, but then I think even more broadly, sort of recognize, oh, these are a set of conversations, they matter. This really resonates with the concerns and thoughts of other scholars. And I'm proud of that and proud of the work of my colleagues who, you know, sort of rode with me. So you always got to recognize, like, they had heart and they rode with me. And that always matters a lot to me.
To listen to the entire conversation I had with Dr. Julian Chambliss and Dr. Scott French regarding the 2024 Zora Festival Afrofuturism Conference, please check out the UCF Department of History's podcast, Knight's History Cast, available wherever you listen to music and podcasts. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
This is Florida Frontiers. Florida's indigenous people didn't have a Super Bowl, but they did play a ball game that was an important part of their culture. Bonnie McEwen is an archaeologist and co-author with John Han of the book The Apalachee Indians and Mission San Luis.
During Spanish colonial times, Indian warriors were often great ball players. In fact, the Apalachee ball game, a type of football, was known as the younger brother of war, because of the skills required and the often violent outcomes. The games were generally played in the spring and summer and were dedicated to the gods of rain and thunder. The Apalachees believed that ballgame victories translated into successful crops. Although Catholic missionaries repeatedly called for the abolition of the games, the Apalachees continued to play them. Much like football today, the most talented ballgame players enjoyed a special status in their communities and were treated like celebrities. The audience enjoyed pre- and post-game rituals and celebrations, and both Spaniards and Indians were known to gamble on the outcome.
Commentary from archaeologist and author Bonnie McEwen. You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and find us on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers this week comes from Sebastian Garcia and Bill Dudley. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.